Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. That music, of course, signals the start of one of our most beloved films, 1939's The Wizard of Oz. We're going to begin today's morning show by playing for you an excerpt from a most memorable conversation which I had several years ago with one of the actors who appeared in that film as a munchkin. His name, Meinhard Robbie. He also achieved some notoriety for being the official spokesperson for Oscar Mayer. For actually decades. And Meinhard Robbie wrote a very intriguing and entertaining memoir about his life and career, a book called Memories of a Munchkin, an illustrated walk down the yellow brick road. The excerpt I want to play for you today focuses specifically on his experience as a munchkin in this classic film. Tell us how your connection was made with the Wizard of Oz film. I mean, how did that opportunity cross your path?
After working with the Oscar Mayer and Madison in accounting, they transferred me to the corporate office in Chicago, where I heard through the grapevine that MGM was going to make this movie, and they wanted all the little people they could get. And I thought, gee, that might be an interesting experience. So I asked the company for a leave of absence, and I headed to California, and fortunately, as they still needed more, all the little people that showed up were hired into the studio as to be the little people as the Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz.
I know that at one point in the book, you give some credit to child actor Jackie Coogan, I think, in terms of why the decision was made to hire little people and not hire children to portray the Munchkins.
Well, corporate information that I wasn't privy to.
Right. But the idea was that there were child labor laws in place in the wake of the work of important child actors like Jackie Coogan, which maybe made it a more viable, practical option for them to use little people, which, of course, worked out so very, very well.
Well, like I say, those decisions were not available to me. That was strictly corporate information.
What was the experience like of stepping into this world as a complete newcomer? Were the vast majority of you newcomers to the world of film?
Well, let's say the scenery and the whole set for the Munchkin Land was really so-called out of this world. It was mind-boggling to someone ordinary way of life. So it was really a tremendous experience, and of course to me it was very, very interesting because most of the other Munchkins were little people with whom I had worked at the various world fairs. So it's like a grand reunion for us.
Well, and you also talk about how this was back in a day when there were hardly any of the gatherings which take place fairly regularly now with little people, even conventions and the like. I mean, this had to be a wonderful experience for you to be with
very much so.
For you to be with so many other little people.
Most of them I had worked with previously, so it was renewing old friendships and, shall we say, being with people that we had worked with before and gathering information as far as their backgrounds, their work experiences.
You, of course, were fortunate to be one of maybe 30 or so Munchkins that were given, in the words of one person, special business. I mean, many of the Munchkins were just, you know, we would call them extras on a film set. But you, of course, and others were given some special roles with which you really had a lot of fun.
Well, the casting director had to pick out the different people. He had certain spots that he needed particular people. And the first ones that he was selected were the three little ladies who were the Lullaby League girls. That was one spot he needed, and there were only three ladies who had toe dancing experience, so they were the first ones to, shall we say, get a top spot.
There is some dancing done, of course, by the Munchkins, and some long rehearsals happened for that. Now, did you need to be involved in any of the dancing, or was that something that other Munchkins did?
I'm sorry, say that again.
There was some dancing done by the Munchkins in that scene. Were you one of the Munchkins that had to dance, or didn't you have to worry about that?
No, I was not in that part. They had a special dancing instructor to a choreography who taught the ones selected to do these various dance steps.
One of the things that is mentioned in the book is that the vast majority of the Munchkin lines of dialogue, and I think even some of the solo lines sung, are actually dubbed in by other actors. Is that right?
That was, of course, shall we say, behind the scenes, that we were not familiar to at the time we were working.
Tell us about the amount of money you were paid.
Well, that again was, shall we say, diminutive, just like we.
It was not quite what you
looked. That was before the unions had had the upper hand in the union in the movie business.
So not a lot of money, but it does sound like, at least for the most part, you were very well treated.
We were very well treated. And let's say it was a wonderful experience, and it, shall we say, gave me the confidence to carry on, and in other words, keep on going, and not worry about being a little person.
Right. You have very warm words of affection for all of the principal actors in the movie, but you reserve your warmest words really for young Judy Garland.
Very much. She was at the time not quite 16, but she had a wonderful personality, and of course we heard her sing, and she was just very congenial with all the little people. In other words, we had the impression that she got as much of a kick out of being with little people as we did working with her.
Very good. I think we should give a special word of praise to the composers of the Wizard of Oz, because that whole wonderful musical sequence in which you are a part is an absolutely beautifully crafted sequence of songs, hilariously funny and musically so bewitching.
Very, very much the people who composed that music really did a terrific job.
Let's talk for a moment about something else which you address in the book, namely some of the rumors which swirled around that so many of the Munchkins were actually ill-behaved. This is a mistruth that you really try to put to rest in your book.
I'm sorry, will you repeat that?
I want you to just address the issue of alleged misbehavior by the Munchkins. You, of course, tell us that wasn't true.
You understand. That was due to the picture that followed, the picture that was specifically made to spoof The Wizard of Oz. In other words, to try and make a fast buck on the reputation of the Wizard of Oz. In other words, the picture over the rainbow, which was absolutely a spoof on The Wizard of Oz, and all the rumors that you speak of originate from that other picture. Not from The Wizard of Oz. A Wizard of Oz, on the set, it was all very tightly scripted, and everybody during the rehearsal, we knew exactly where we had, what yellow brick we had to be on at certain times. In other words, if the director says cut, we had to stay put on that yellow brick where we stopped and ready to start out. So we squatted on that same yellow brick, and when he started to shoot again, that's where we started out from.
So this was really a very disciplined set, and the Munchkins were just as disciplined as anyone else.
Correct. It was very well done. You understand, our director, Victor Fleming, after he finished our part, he went on to do, who did another very famous picture, and so that he really made his, shall we say, enlarge his reputation from his success with The Wizard of Oz.
Meinhard Robbie portrayed the coroner in the 1939 classic film The Wizard of Oz. He went on to serve for several decades as the official spokesperson for Oscar Mayer Company. His very entertaining memoir about his most eventful life is titled Memories of a Munchkin, An Illustrated Walk Down the Yellow Brick Road. Coming up, a look at some of the most spectacular Christmas decorations and a look back at the history of when we first began decorating our houses and homes with Christmas lights. Also, a look at some of the reasons why it maybe makes sense to live more simply. That's coming up on today's morning show here on WGTD.
From now on, you'll be history.
You'll be history.
You'll be history.
You'll be history.
And we will glorify your name.
You'll be a bust.
Be a bust.
Be a bust.
In the Hall of Fame.
It's 8:25 here on WGTD. Part two of today's program features an excerpt from my conversation with Bruce Littlefield, the author of Merry Christmas America, Megawatt Displays Across the USA. Mr. Littlefield traveled across the country to seek out some of the most outrageously spectacular Christmas displays which people had outside of their homes, and met some of these people to talk with them about what seemed to drive them to decorate their homes in such a way. I mean, I think the main reason people are going to pick up this book is to look at these incredible photographs of these incredible Christmas displays. Just ahead of that, though, I would love to have you kind of talk to our listeners a little bit about some of the history that you explain at the front of the book.
Sure.
About when this whole business of electric lights was first created.
Yes.
I was astonished to read how early this this was developed.
Pretty amazing, right? 1882. It was created by a guy named Edward Johnson, who was the partner of Thomas Edison. And, you know, he decided that he'd like to add something to his Christmas tree in his Fifth Avenue apartment, and he created 80 red, white, and blue, like walnut-sized lights for his Christmas tree, and invited his friends over. And as I say in the book, Christmas was dark nevermore.
Hmm.
It was the beginning of what is now a phenomenon. As you said that people go out of their way to decorate, and I say they go over the top. You know,
yeah.
It's like they really climb on their houses and really go for it.
And it's like in a way that it was not, let's say, 50 years ago, it's like this concerted effort, in which they sit down and plan. I mean, it isn't just the kind of, it's not just one more thing
Yep.
they do during the holidays. I mean, for many people, it's the central thing they do during the holidays.
And it's one of the themes of their year. I mean, literally, many of the people that I talk to in the book plan their Christmas displays all year long because they feel that they are, what they're doing is their gift to their community. And, you know, when you see the kids or the folks that show up in front of these displays, you realize that they are indeed doing something that is a community service, something that is going to brighten other people's lives.
Let's back up to the history for just another
Yep.
moment. As you mentioned, we can look in 1882 for the first electric lights on a Christmas tree. You tell us 1895 was when the first time an electrically lit Christmas tree was displayed at the White House. And you suggest that this really had impact for the country. I mean, this is what really paved the way for this to be a part of many Americans' lives.
Well, it did. Grover Cleveland started the tradition at the White House. And you know what's interesting that I found interesting about that was that during that time, it was the very high society that had their Christmas trees. In fact, the Christmas tree, to have a lighted Christmas tree in that time period, which was the late 1800s, was about a $300 expense. So you can imagine how expensive that was in the late 1800s to spend $300.
That would be thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Exactly.
Now.
To spend $300 now on a tree is a lot of money. So, I mean, it was real high society.
Hmm.
And then by the 1920s, General Electric had come out, and I think it was actually 1902, a Ladies' Home Journal ad came out, and they were selling Christmas lights, General Electric. And by 1920, they decided that they were going to sponsor around the country like decorating with color light contest. So they had newspapers that participated all across the country, and each family in the country began to want to have their Christmas tree lit. Hmm.
You talk in the book about over the many years, I think these are maybe your childhood years, although I'm not absolutely certain, about a neighborhood Christmas decorating contest and how you were always hoping for first place and it just never quite came your way.
Never quite happened. Still hasn't happened. But, you know, it started when I think I was about 13 and my neighborhood decided to have their own decorating contest. And the prize wasn't anything but a sign that says you were the best in the neighborhood. And I remember it being this cute little sign with red letters, and it said, you know, best house. And I wanted to be the best house. That first year, my dad worked at the local nylon plant, and he had some flawed nylon, red nylon, and I literally took that nylon and tried to wrap our house to look like a present. And and my dad still talks about that was the year that I rendered the front door completely useless. But the joy of that moment was that instead of winning the contest, I got my picture in the paper as the kid who, quote, tried to wrap his house. And so it became every year another attempt for me to try to win the decorating contest.
So when you set about to write this book and to visit some of these incredible sights of Christmas decorating gone over the top. I mean, this is like returning to the mothership for you.
Yes, and to get in my marching orders, my instructions, I literally thought, well, I want to see how these people do it and why they do it. Because, you know, you heard my reason. I wanted to be the guy who was the best in the neighborhood. But all the people around the country that do this in such a large, over-the-top way, they do it for particular reasons. Like, in Florida, I found a woman whose young daughter passed away when the daughter was 8 years old. She died right before Christmas. She loved the Christmas, going to see Christmas lights. And instead of the family, you know, just being distraught, they decided to make something out of it. And they took her the stand up for at the funeral for the flowers. It was a little tripod stand. They took it home, put it in the center of their yard, and wrapped lights around it, and made it as sort of a memorial to their daughter. Well, 18 years later, they still do it, but that little Christmas tree is still in the center of their yard, and it's surrounded by just, you know, a whole collection of incredible, beautiful Christmas things.
Hmm.
And each family that I met have their reason for doing it.
Another, right. You know, I think that's one of the things that's striking about the book, because I think for anybody who looks at this and thinks, oh my gosh, there's something kind of sick about this, or this seems like, I mean, maybe a holly jolly addiction.
Yes.
There are certain stories that might confirm those fears, and then other stories in this book in which it really seems like there is something more laudable going on here. And
yeah,
that for some people it really is an effort to bring joy to their own lives and the lives of others.
Exactly. You know, I tell the story in the book, and there's in Seattle, there's a place called Candy Cane Lane, and it was started in the early 50s by a guy that was a Japanese internment camp survivor. And when he after the war, when he was released, he went back to Seattle. And in order to show that his spirit and love for our country was still strong, he created a passion scene in his yard, and it was very well received. And the following Christmas, he had enjoyed the previous reception so much that he began to create things for his neighbors, and he created one by one a little candy canes made out of stovepipe, and that he hand-painted and made very special. Well, by, you know, 10 years later, the entire street, a little cul-de-sac, had begun to have decorations on their house, and now it is truly one of the Seattle institution. I had gone there in the late 70s with my aunt and remembered it fondly, and then last year I got to go again, and it is still going strong, and it's sort of one of those acts of community cooperation that just really makes you feel good about being an American.
Hmm. You tell a real interesting story that I think of what turned out to be a real surprise for you, because let's face it, 90% of what we see are candy canes and elves and gingerbread men and Santa and Rudolph and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And of course, for many people, that embodies Christmas as much as anything. And then there are other people where, of course, all of that is beside the central point of why there even is a holiday called Christmas. You ended up meeting a family at some point, I think during your travels through North Carolina.
Yes.
And the father turned out to be a Baptist minister.
Yes, and in fact, I was shooting in their front yard. They weren't home, and he came home, and they realized that I was, you know, in love with their display. And it wasn't anything outrageous. It was really just a little small tree in their yard, and they had done the edge of their house. But it was, you could tell that a certain love went into doing what they did. And he said, "Listen, I want to take you somewhere. I want to take you to my favorite house," which a lot of the families did want to share their favorite. Even though they had their own display, they wanted to share their favorite house with me. And he took me to this house that truly, it was like Clark Griswold from the movie Vacation lived there. Every square inch of the house was covered in Christmas lights. And as we stood outside, he said, "It's amazing, isn't it?" And I said, "Oh, it really, really is." And he said, and I said, "Well, can you, you know, tell me what you think about Christmas and what the meaning of Christmas is?" And he said, "Well, I'm a Baptist minister, and I know the meaning of Christmas." But then he began to tell me that besides the you know, the story of Jesus's birth, that it also had other incredible meanings to him, which is that it was, you know, of course the spirituality of Christmas is a part of it, but it was that that Christmas evokes sort of a magical feeling of the wonder of life, and whether it be children or older people, that it's a magic that makes us feel awestruck. And as he sort of drove away, and I thought, you know, it really is, Christmas is a time that we're able to tell the people that we care about, that we love them without feeling all sappy. You know, we're able to give them a gift and to say, "Hey, I really care about you." And it just feels right, you know. And I think in particularly these, you know, sort of sad and hard times we are faced every day with bad news coming at us from all angles, I think Christmas time is one of those times that our life can be lightened and brightened.
Well, and that's certainly what you're told by this guy named Jerry Weingarten and his home, which is all but encased in lights. I mean, not just you know, the outlines that we're used to seeing in windows, but I mean, it's practically solid lights.
And, yeah, every square inch.
And he doesn't get very specific, or at least you don't share any specifics with us, but he touches on this on having experienced some darkness, he and his family, and how this is one of their ways to say they're not giving in to the darkness that has been part of their lives.
Yeah, he told me some you know, a really hard story that his family had gone through a really hard time, and instead of just dwelling in their sadness and their, you know, the hardship, he decided that he would take to his house and put some little, you know, throw some Christmas around. You know that song from Mame, "We Need a Little Christmas," right this very minute. And that's what he felt like. And so he took to his house, and as the lights went up, he began to realize that his spirits brightened. And the more he did, the happier he became. And he said, I can't remember if I used this in the book, but he said, "Well, we can't wash our clothes during the Christmas season because our power will go out."
Oh,
but
dear.
We're certainly a happy family now.
Interesting. One thing that I think is probably worth maybe just touching on, I mean, sometimes you're showing us pictures of homes where it looks like, I mean, these people know something about decorating. And then we'll see other pictures, and we'll think, these people probably know nothing about decorating. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing, too, how for some people they appear to be guided by kind of, you know, an artistic vision. Yeah. And then there are others who just seem to be doing not much more than just kind of piling it on, I mean, to extraordinary lengths. And yet, you know, it's a free country and it's their home. And but it's just fascinating to see the difference in way, yeah, in the ways people can go about doing this.
Well, it's funny, Greg. I say that, you know, you like vanilla, I like chocolate. You say tomato, I say tomato. You know, it's like people do have a different vision of what Christmas spectacle should be. And some people do it, and it's, for my taste, it's stunningly beautiful. And other people do it, and it's outrageously hilarious. And whatever they do, I've actually had a good time experiencing their vision of it. Some of the quote unquote over the top tacky, self-described tacky decorators enjoy that and enjoy being the sort of plastic yard. You know,
they have no illusions of it being anything else. I mean, they don't presume to think that this is beautiful what they've done.
Yeah, well, they think there's beauty in the tackiness.
Right, or it's about being spectacular.
Well, exactly, certainly.
As you met these people, how much did you have a sense that at least in some cases this is something gone amok a little bit? I mean, that it is somebody with kind of an insatiable addiction, and you know, maybe people that are devoting time and energy and money that, you know, could be putting food on someone's table or whatever. I mean, how much did you wrestle with that?
You know what? I have to be honest with you. I didn't wrestle with that at all. I found that the people that I met were so joyful. They were so excited about what they were doing that I could only think that it was manifesting well in the rest of their life. People that would stop at these houses and see such, outrageous displays, their lives were lifted. And you know that old saying, when you give, you get? I think that for the people that decorated, to stand from their perspective in their living rooms, to look out their windows and to see all of those people getting such joy in their front yards, you can't help but think that that's going to, you know, manifest well in their lives. So I didn't have anything but really joyful experiences to watch. And the one common thread that I found in all the people that I met was that they were all kind, very kind souls.
Hmm. You also talk, and this actually surprised me, you've already touched on certain neighborhoods. I mean, right here in Kenosha, we have a similar sort of neighborhood called Christmas Lane, where essentially every single house for a couple of city blocks spectacularly decorates their homes and yards, and it's something that people come from miles around to see. And it speaks of kind of a cooperation. And then you'll show us other pictures in which we'll have one spectacular thing and then more normal houses next door. But you paint a picture of often where the neighbors don't seem to mind very much.
Yes. It's true. Some of the neighborhoods seem to pay sort of homage to the person that is their star attraction. So they might, for example, in Richmond, one house that actually the cover of my book, that house is sort of the star attraction in that Mechanicsville, Virginia neighborhood. But the neighbors all line their road with little candy canes or lights or things that sort of direct you to the main event. And the neighbors will sit in their driveways and talk to people at night, and they sort of revel in it. So, it's the kind of thing that the people in the neighborhoods that aren't all decorated do try to celebrate the person that is decorated.
Do you end up having one single favorite?
Yes, I do. And it's hard to pick favorites, but one guy touched me and just really made me happy to talk to him. And he's a guy that creates everything in his yard. He hand makes, and his name is Al Thompson. And he is an affable guy. He and his wife never were able to have children, and he had a love of going to a Christmas house as a child, and he remembered the joy of it. And he asked his wife if they could, you know, decorate their house in an outrageous way so that the kids could enjoy it. And they do it with such glee. And I was there one night when an elderly nursing home tour group, a bus, pulled up in front of his yard, and he asked me if I wanted to climb on the bus with him while he talked to everyone. And when he climbed on that bus, it was as if, you know, a major celebrity had climbed aboard. Those people cheered him and were so excited. These, you know, 80 and 90-year-olds were 8 and 9-year-olds. They were brought back to, you know, children. And he was hilarious. He began sort of going through what the display how much effort it took and what it takes. He said, you know, it's 400 hours to put it up and 150 hours to take it down. And then he sort of counted out that there are 425 extension cords and 80 plugs and 40 breakers. And he went through this whole list. And when he finished, he goes, the bus just cheered. And he said, is there any other questions? He basically told him everything. He said, is there any other questions? And you can't believe almost every hand on the bus shot up with questions. They were so excited. It was like school kids being there. It was just wonderful. So that's one of my favorite memories, is talking to him.
Hmm. I realize I neglected to ask you how you found these people. I mean, obviously, it's not hard. In some ways, it's not hard to find a house that's covered with spectacular Christmas decorations. But, I mean, Actually, in some ways, it can be a little bit tricky in larger cities and so on. But how did you end up connecting with the people who's decorating you picture and talk about in the book?
Good, very good question. I started, I knew of a few displays around the country. Like I said, I knew of Seattle's Candy Cane Lane. I knew that Newport Beach in California does an annual boat parade, which is spectacular. I knew from my friend in Colorado that Denver does a great botanical garden display, and I knew from my friend in Austin that Austin has a trail of lights that's incredible. And so I started talking to all my friends that I know about what they like to go see at Christmas around the country. So that was one way. And then I remembered from my childhood that Richmond, Virginia did this thing called the Tacky Light Tour, and I decided that I would start there. Because I knew that it would be a concentrated area of a lot of lights, and because they do this list in the paper. And so I began there. But each of the people that I went, the houses that I went to, they would tell me about their favorite places, or have you heard about, or did you see? And I kept great notes. And then in the four-week period that I was traveling, I literally would change my plans based on what people said, and would journey to I tried to hit a city a night, but in some towns I stayed two or three nights.
Bruce Littlefield's book about spectacular Christmas displays across the country is titled Merry Christmas America, Megawatt Displays Across the USA. It's published by Collins Design, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. And now we turn to something a bit simpler. Wanda Urbanska is well known for some of the work she has done on PBS and in the books she has written on the topic of simplicity, of living simply. One of her books is titled The Heart of Simple Living, Seven Paths to a Better Life. Do you feel like your own life has unfolded fairly consistently when it comes to this matter of living simply? Or have you found yourself going through phases in your life where this has been maybe less attractive to you or more difficult for you to achieve?
Very good question, and very perceptive question, because as an American, I'm very much influenced by American values, American popular culture. So certainly in my youth, in my teens and 20s, I think I was much more drawn to consumer culture and the idea of acquisition, the desire for a big, large house, and the concept of luxury living was much more attractive to me than it is today. So yes, there has been an evolution in my own personal development. And I, like, as a female, I just loved shopping when I was a teenager and in my 20s. But now it's just not something I want to spend my time doing. And I feel like I have all I need. And if anything, I'm streamlining and decluttering and moving things on down the line.
You mentioned in the book that this book and our conversation come at a time in our nation's history when many people, out of utter necessity, are rethinking some of these priorities. And many people, very much against their will, find themselves sort of torn from the life of comfort and luxury and affluence which they had once enjoyed. And fear maybe not ever enjoying again. Just talk a moment about that, because it seems to me there might be a real difference between simply going after some of these lifestyle changes because one simply wants to versus feeling sort of compelled by life circumstances.
Right. Well, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, Greg, and I certainly hope there'll be a silver lining for people who've been forced into a simpler lifestyle. I mean, I hope that they will find new pleasures and routines that will be, you know, fulfilling to them. But yes, we are living at this moment, a moment in history when the need for simplicity is greater than ever, and the turn towards simplicity is real. In fact, I do believe that we have reached a tipping point and that the era of overconsumption in America is over. And there are a number of factors that I can point to that bolster that point of view. One is house size. For decades, since the 1940s, new house size in America has been expanding. Up until 2006, when the average home in America was something over 2,600 square feet, very quickly, as an adaptation to the Great Recession, it's been contracting very rapidly. And Americans are showing a preference for smaller homes. I mean, maybe not micro homes, but they're realizing that the size of home, if you have a large home, you need to heat it, you need to furnish it, you need to clean it. All of those things have costs, carry costs with them. And so we're moving toward what I say is one of the paths to a simpler life, small, green, and paid for. So if you can buy a home that you can pay off more quickly, you'll be in a more comfortable, more luxurious, really, state of mind than if you have a much bigger house than you actually need. Now, another factor that bolsters this concept that the age of overconsumption is over is the rate at which, the rapidity with which we Americans have begun to save money. Up until 2006, people, young adults up to age 35, were spending $117 for every $100 they brought in. But fast forward 2 years, and suddenly they're saving $5 out of every $100. That is extremely dramatic. It signals to me that frugality is being embraced as a value, because this is coming at a time when many people are being laid off, when people are getting pay cuts. So they're actually saving at this time, at a time when you would think they'd be tapping savings. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Wanda Urbanska. We're talking about a book that's just been published in paperback called The Heart of Simple Living, Seven Paths to a Better Life. By the way, could you explain the top of that title, The Heart of Simple Living? I am intrigued by your choice of words there.
Well, the heart of simple living, I believe that simple living is a concept that is a way of life that's being led with your heart. Because when you live simply, you're living generously. You're making time for others. You're making time for conversation, for such things as sit-down meals. it's getting away from the multitasking that so many of us have embraced in recent years and from technology. So simple living is living with heart. It's living in the present moment. It's living generously. It's taking time just to be.
Let's talk about the seven paths in a little more detail. We've already been touching on the first one, the first of your seven paths to this simpler life. Live frugally, save money, retire debt as fast as you can. It's intriguing to me that your list begins with kind of the nitty-gritty, sometimes harsh reality of finances.
Yes.
Is it first because it's the most important, or is it first because it's sort of the first thing that should be addressed? Why is this the first of these seven?
You know, that's really interesting you asked that question. My mother, who's been reading the book, asked me the same question. Why did you put money first? I think that we need to have our financial houses in order to move forward in life. Because if you're up late nights worrying about how you're going to pay your rent or your mortgage or if your car is going to be repossessed, it's very difficult to achieve a simpler life until you achieve financial independence. And many of these things can't be done overnight, but you can take small steps and you can set long-term goals. The book is full of tips, you know, as well as stories, as well as drawing on narrative from my own life. But, you know, for instance, one of the things that I embraced and have for a number of years is paying bills immediately, because I think that the sooner you get a bill paid, the more quickly it's off the slate and mentally you can move on, as opposed to people who delay paying bills or pay just as little as they can. I think that there's a difference, a sort of a psychological difference in your financial health and well-being.
One of the most interesting bits of information in this chapter, as far as I was concerned, is when you talked about how so many Americans have it backwards. This is what you write. Too many of us spend out our dreams in our youth. Think of extravagant weddings, late model cars, fancy vacations, and state-of-the-art electronics. Sometimes the young lovebirds are divorced before the wedding's paid off and may be forced into penury in old age. Much better to reverse this order. Live modestly and sensibly while young, when youth is a priceless privilege, and salt away your money for old age when it will matter more. Explain particularly that last part. In what way will money matter more when we are older?
Well, money will matter more when we are older because it may be less easy, and of course we're generalizing, but it may be harder to make money when you're older. One may be disabled, one may be, you know, struggling with medical conditions, and one does not know what the future economy brings. Many people are questioning how solvent Social Security and other programs will be. So it's better to sort of set yourself up, develop smart and wise financial habits in your youth, and, you know, sort of lay a good foundation and framework for your middle and older age. I referenced, and by the way, I love the way you read that. I reference my niece, Teresa Miriam Van Hoy, who managed to save $90,000 when she was, you know, making a very scant salary as a foreign language teacher at a private school in Connecticut back in the 1980s. And it was incredible because there's many doctors and high-paid professionals who can't put away that kind of money. But she really embraced and adopted an extreme frugality regime and just earned, you know, had second jobs on the weekends, was, you know, swapping out services. I remember she would sometimes babysit for her students at her private school, and the parents would say, well, you know, we're redecorating. Take all this furniture for your place. And if she didn't need it, she would resell it. So she was operating on a lot of different levels. But now her house is paid for. She's putting her two sons through college, she and her husband. And she's setting herself up for a very comfortable middle to older age.
Wanda Urbanska. Her book, one of a number that she has written, is titled The Heart of Simple Living, Seven Paths to a Better Life.